Chapter 8. But this analysis of the modifying factors in the home influence, this formulation of its controllable elements, has now gone as far as the purpose of this paper requires. It has worked out to this, that the home, so far as it is not traditional organization, is really only on the one hand an aspect of the general economic condition of the state, and on the other of that still more fundamental thing, its general atmosphere of thought. Our analysis refers back the man-maker to these two questions. The home, one gathers, is not to be dealt with separately or simply. Nor, on the other hand, are these questions to be dealt with merely in relation to their home application. As the citizen grows up, he presently emerges from his home influences to a more direct and general contact with these two things, with the fact of the modern state, and with the thought of the modern state, and we must consider each of these in relation to his development as a whole. The next group of elements in the man-making complex that occurs to one after the home is the school. Let me repeat a distinction already drawn between the home element in boarding schools and the school proper. While the child is out of the schoolroom, playing except when it is drilling or playing under direction, when it is talking with its playmates, walking, sleeping, eating, it is under those influences that it has been convenient for me to speak of as the home influence. The schoolmaster who takes boarders is, I hold, merely a substitute for the parent, the household of boarders merely a substitute for the family. What is meant by school here is that which is possessed in common by day school and boarding school, the schoolroom and the recess playground part. It is something which the savage and the barbarian distinctively do not possess as a phase in their making, and scarcely even its rudimentary suggestion. It is a new element correlated with the establishment of a wider political order, and with the use of written speech. Now I think it will be generally conceded that whatever systematic intellectual training the developing citizen gets, as distinguished from his natural, accidental, and incidental development, is got in school or in its subsequent development of college, and with that I will put aside the question of intellectual development altogether for a later, fuller discussion. My point here is simply to note the school as a factor in the making of almost every citizen in the modern state, and to point out, what is sometimes disregarded, that it is only one of many factors in that making. The tendency of the present time is enormously to exaggerate the importance of school in development, to ascribe to it powers quite beyond its utmost possibilities, and to blame it for evils in which it has no share. And in the most preposterous invasions of the duties of parent, clergyman, statesman, author, journalist, of duties which are in truth scarcely more within the province of a schoolmaster than they are within the province of a butcher, the real and necessary work of the school is too often marred, crippled, and lost sight of altogether. We treat the complex, difficult and honorable task of intellectual development as if it were within the capacity of any earnest but muddle-headed young lady or any half-educated gentleman in orders. We take that for granted, and we demand in addition from them the formation of character, moral and ethical training and supervision, aesthetic guidance, the implanting of a taste for the best in literature, for the best in art, for the finest conduct. We demand the clue to success in commerce, and the seeds of a fine passionate patriotism from these necessarily very ordinary persons. One might think schoolmasters and schoolmistresses were inaccessible to general observation in the face of these stupendous demands. If we exacted such things from our butcher over and above good service in his trade, if we insisted that his meat should not only build up honest nerve and muscle, but that it should compensate for all that was slovenly in our homes, dishonest in our economic conditions, and slack and vulgar in our public life, he would very probably say that it took him all his time to supply sound meat, that it was a difficult and honorable thing to supply sound meat, that the slackness of businessmen and statesmen in the country, the condition of the arts and sciences, wasn't his business, that however lamentable. the disorders of the state, there was no reasonable prospect of improving it by upsetting the distribution of meat, and, in short, that he was a butcher and not a cosmos healing quack. "Why, you must have meat," he would say, "anyhow." But the average schoolmaster and schoolmistress does not do things in that way. What a school may do for the developing citizen, the original and the developed function of the school, and how its true work may best be accomplished, we shall discuss later. But it may be well to expand a little more fully here the account of what the school has no business to attempt, and what the scholastic profession is, as a whole, quite incapable of doing, and to point to the really responsible agencies in each case. Now, firstly, with regard to all that the schoolmaster and schoolmistress means by the formation of character. A large proportion of the scholastic profession will profess, and a still larger proportion of the public believes, that it is possible by talk and specially designed instruction to give a boy or girl a definite bias towards Ruth, towards X called Ilfi, a word that would puzzle the ordinary schoolmaster or schoolmistress extremely to define, glib as they are with it, towards honor, towards generosity, enterprise, self-reliance, and the like. The masters in our public schools are far from blameless in this respect, and you may gauge the quality of many of these gentlemen pretty precisely by their disposition towards the school pulpit line of business. Half an hour's straight talk to the boys, impromptu vague sentimentality about earnestness, thoroughness, true patriotism, and so forth, seems to assuage the conscience as nothing else could do. 4 weeks of ill-prepared, ill-planned teaching, and years of preoccupation with rowing boats and cricket. The more extreme examples of this type will say in a tone of manly apology, "It does the boys good to tell them plainly what I think about serious things," when the simple fact of the case is too often that he does all he can not to think about any things of any sort whatever, except cricket and promotion. Schoolmistresses, again, will sometimes come near boasting to the inquiring parent of our fickle hour, and if you probe the facts you will find that means no more and no less than an hour of floundering egotism, in which a poor logical soul, with a sort of naive indecency, talks nonsense about deals, about the higher and the better, about purity, and about many secret and sacred things, things upon which wise men are often profoundly uncertain, to incredulous or imitative children. All that is needed to do this sort of thing abundantly and freely is a certain degree of aggressive egotism, a certain gift of stupidity, good intentions, and a defective sense of educational possibilities and limitations. In addition to moral discussions, that at the best are very second-rate eloquence, and at the worst are respect-destroying, mind-destroying gabble, there are various forms of fickle teaching, advocated and practiced in America and in the elementary schools of this country. For example, a story of an edifying sort is told to the children, and comments are elicited upon the behavior of the characters. "Would you have done that?" Oh, no, teacher. "Why not?" Because it would be mean. The teacher goes into particulars, whittling away at the verdict, and at last the fine point of the lesson stands out. Now it may be indisputable that such lessons can be conducted effectively and successfully by exceptionally brilliant teachers, that children may be given an excellent code of good intentions, and a wonderful skill in the research for good or bad motives for any given course of action they may or may not want to take, but that they can be systematically trained by the average teacher at our disposal in this desirable subject is quite another question. It is one of the things that the educational reformer must guard against most earnestly, the persuasion that what an exceptional man can do ever and again for display purposes can be done successfully day by day in schools. This applies to many other things besides the teaching of ethics. Professor Armstrong can give delightfully instructive lessons in chemistry according to the heuristic method, but in the hands of the average teacher by whom teaching must be done for the next few years, the heuristic system will result in nothing but a pointless fumble. Mr. Mackinder teaches geography inimitably just to show how to do it. Mr. David Devon, the brilliant Egyptian hall conjurer, will show any assembly of parents how to amuse children quite easily, but for some reason he does not present his legerdemain as a new discovery in educational method. To our argument that this sort of teaching is not within the capacity of such teachers as we have, or are likely to have, we can, fortunately enough, add that whatever is attempted can be done far better through other agencies. More or less unknown to teachers, there exists a considerable amount of well-written literature, true stories and fiction, in which, without any clumsy insistence upon moral points, fine actions are displayed in their elementary fineness, and baseness is seen to be base. There are also a few theaters, and there might be more, in which fine action is finely displayed. Now one nobly conceived and nobly rendered play will give a stronger moral impression than the best schoolmaster conceivable, talking ethics for a year on end. One great and stirring book may give an impression less powerful, perhaps, but even more permanent. Practically these things are as good as example they are example. Surround your growing boy or girl with a generous supply of good books, and leave writer and growing soul to do their business together without any scholastic control of their intercourse. Make your state healthy, your economic life healthy and honest, be honest and truthful in the pulpit, behind the counter, in the office, and your children will need no specific ethical teaching, they will inhale right. And without these things all the ethical teaching in the world will only sour to cant at the first wind of the breath of the world. Quite without ethical pretension at all, the school is of course bound to influence the moral development of the child. That most important matter, the habit and disposition towards industry, should be acquired there, the sense of thoroughness in execution, the profound belief that difficulty is bound to yield to a resolute attack, all these things are the necessary byproducts of a good school. A teacher who is punctual, persistent, just, who tells the truth, and insists upon the truth, who is truthful, not merely technically, but in a constant search for exact expression, whose own share of the schoolwork is faultlessly done, who is tolerant to effort, and a tireless helper, who is obviously more interested in serious work than in puerile games, will beget essential manliness in every boy he teaches. He need not lecture on his virtues. A slack, emotional, unpunctual, inexact, and illogical teacher, a fawning loyalist, an incredible pietist, an energetic snob, a teacher as eager for games, as sensitive to social status, as easy, kindly, and sentimental, and as shy really of hard toil as some teachers, is none the better for ethical flatulence. There is a good deal of cant in certain educational circles, there is a certain type of educational writing in which Ove is altogether too strongly present, a reasonably extensive observation of school children and school teachers makes one doubt whether there is ever anything more than a very temperate affection, and a still more temperate admiration on either side. Children see through their teachers amazingly, and what they do not understand now they will understand later. For a teacher to lay hands on all the virtues, to associate them with his or her personality, to smear characteristic phrases and expressions over them, is as likely as not to give the virtues unpleasant associations. Better far, save through practice, to leave them alone altogether. And what is here said of this tainting of moral instruction with the personality of the teacher applies still more forcibly to religious instruction. Here, however, I enter upon a field where I am anxious to avoid dispute. To my mind, those ideas and emotions that center about the idea of God appear at once too great and remote, and too intimate and subtle for objective treatment. But there are a great number of people, unfortunately, who regard religion as no more than geography, who believe that it can be got in 2 daily lessons of 1 hour, and adequately done by any poor soul who has been frightened into conformity by the fear of dismissal. And having this knobby, portable creed, and believing sincerely that lip conformity is alone necessary to salvation, they want to force every teacher they can to acquire and impart its indestructible and flexible recipes, and they are prepared to enforce this at the price of inefficiency in every other school function. We must all agree, whatever we believe or disbelieve, that religion is the crown of the edifice we build. But it will simply ruin a vital part of the edifice, and misuse our religion very greatly, if we hand it over to the excavators and bricklayers of the mind, to use as a cheap substitute for the proper intellectual and ethical foundations. For the ethical foundation which is schooling, and the ethical foundation which is habit. I must confess that there is only one sort of man whose insistence upon religious teaching in schools by ordinary school teachers I can understand, and that is the downright atheist, the man who believes sensual pleasure is all that there is of pleasure, and virtue no more than a hood, to check the impetuosity of youth until discretion is acquired, the man who believes there is nothing else in the world but hard material fact, and who has as much respect for truth and religion as he has for stable manure. Such a man finds it convenient to profess a lax version of the popular religion, and he usually does so, and invariably he wants his children out of religion, because he so utterly disbelieves in God, goodness, and spirituality that he cannot imagine young people doing even enough right to keep healthy and prosperous, unless they are humbugged into it. Equally unnecessary is the scholastic attempt to take over the relations of the child to a tour, art, and literature. To read the educational journals, to hear the scholastic enthusiast, one would think that no human being would ever discover there was any such thing as a tour were it not for the schoolmaster and quotation from Wordsworth. And this nature, as they present it, is really not nature at all, but a factitious admiration for certain isolated aspects of the universe conventionally regarded as natural. Few schoolmasters have discovered that for every individual there are certain aspects of the universe that especially appeal, and that that appeal is part of the individuality different from every human being, and quite outside their range. Certain things that have been rather well treated by poets and artists for the most part dead, and of academic standing, they regard as nature, and all the rest of the world, most of the world in which we live, as being in some way an intrusion upon this classic. They propound a wanton and illogical canon. Trees, rivers, flowers, birds, stars are, and have been for many centuries nature, so are plowed fields really the most artificial of all things, and all the apparatus of the agriculturist, cattle, vermin, weeds, wheat fires, and all the rest of it. A grassy old embankment, to protect low-lying fields is nature, and so is all the mass of apparatus about a water mill. A new embankment to store an urban water supply, though it may be one mass of splendid weeds, is artificial and ugly. A wooden windmill is nature and beautiful, a sky sign atrocious. Mountains have become nature and beautiful within the last 100 years, volcanoes even. Vesuvius, for example, is grand and beautiful, its smell of underground railway most impressive, its night effect stupendous. But the glowing cinder heaps of Burslem, the wonders of the black country sunset, the wonderful fire-shot nightfall of the Five Towns, these things are horrid and offensive and vulgar beyond the powers of scholastic language. Such a mass of clotted inconsistencies, such a wild confusion of vicious mental practices as this, is the stuff the schoolmaster has in mind when he talks of children acquiring a love of nature. They are to be trained, against all their mental bias, to observe and quote about the canonical natural objects, and not to observe, but instead to shun and contemn everything outside the canon, and so to hand on the orthodox love of nature to another generation. One may present the triumph of scholastic nature teaching by the figure of a little child hurrying to school along the ways of a busy modern town. She carries a faded cut flower, got at considerable cost from a botanical garden, and as she goes she counts its petals, its stamens, its bracteoles. Her love of nature, her hours of observation, are being trained. About her, all unheeded, is a wonderful life that she would be intent upon, but for this precious training of her mind. Great electric trains loom wonderfully round corners, go droning by, spitting fire from their overhead wires. Great shop windows display a multitudinous variety of objects. Men and women come and go about a thousand businesses. A street organ splashes a spray of notes at her as she passes. A hoarding splashes a spray of color. The shape and direction of one's private observation is no more the schoolmaster's business than the shape and direction of one's nose. It is, indeed, possible to certain gifted and exceptional persons that they should not only see acutely, but abstract and express again what they have seen. Such people are artists, a different kind of people from schoolmasters altogether. Into all sorts of places, where people have failed to see, comes the artist like a light. The artist cannot create, nor can he determine the observation of other men, but he can, at any rate, help and inspire it. But he and the pedagogue are temperamentally different and apart. They are at opposite poles of human quality. The pedagogue with his canon comes between the child and nature, only to limit and obscure. His business is to leave the whole thing alone. If the interpretation of nature is a rare and peculiar gift, the interpretation of art and literature is surely an even rarer thing. Hundreds of schoolmasters and schoolmistresses who could not write one tolerable line of criticism will stand up in front of classes by the hour together and issue judgments on books, pictures, and all that is comprised under the name of art. Think of it. Here is your great artist, your great exceptional mind groping in the darknesses beneath the surface of life, half apprehending strange elusive things in those profundities, and striving sometimes to the utmost verge of human endeavor to give that strange unsuspected mystery expression, to shape it, to shadow it in form and wonder of color, in beautiful rhythms, in fantasies of narrative, in gracious and glowing words. So much in its essential and precious degree is art. Think of what the world must be in the wider vision of the great artist. Think, for example, of the dark splendors amidst which the mind of Leonardo clambered, the mirror of tender lights that reflected into our world the iridescent graciousness of Botticelli. Then to the faint and faded intimations these great men have left us of the things beyond our scope, comes the scholastic intelligence, gesticulating instructively, and in too many cases obscuring forever the naive vision of the child. The scholastic intelligence, succulently appreciative, blind, hopelessly blind to the fact that every great work of art is a strenuous, an almost despairing effort to express and convey, treats the whole thing as some foolish riddle, explains it to the children. As if every picture was a rebus and every poem a charade. "Well, little children," he says, "this teaches you," and out comes the platitude. Of late years, in Great Britain more particularly, the school has been called upon to conquer still other fields. It has become apparent that in this monarchy of ours, in which honor is heaped high upon money-making, even if it is money-making that adds nothing to the collective wealth or efficiency, and denied to the most splendid public services, unless they are also remunerative, where public applause is the meat of cricketers, hostile guerrillas, clamorous authors, yacht-racing grocers, and hopelessly incapable generals, and where suspicion and ridicule are the lot of every man working hard, and living hard for any end beyond a cabman's understanding. In this worldwide empire whose government is entrusted as a matter of course to peers, and denied as a matter of course to any man of humble origin, Where social pressure of the most urgent kind compels every capable business manager to sell out to a company and become a gentleman at the very earliest opportunity, the national energy is falling away. That driving zeal, that practical vigor, that once distinguished the English is continually less apparent. Our workmen take no pride in their work any longer, they shirk toil and gamble. And what is worse, the master takes no pride in the works, he too, shirks toil and gambles. Our middle-class young men, instead of flinging themselves into study, into research, into literature, into widely conceived business enterprises, into so much of the public service as is not preserved for the sons of the well-connected, play games, display an almost oriental slackness in the presence of work and duty, and seem to consider it rather good form to do so. And seeking for some reason and some remedy for this remarkable phenomenon, a number of patriotic gentlemen have discovered that the schools are to blame. Something in the nature of reform has to be waved over our schools. It would be a wicked deed to write anything that might seem to imply that our schools were not in need of very extensive reforms, or that their efficiency is not a necessary preliminary condition to general public efficiency, but, indeed, the schools are only one factor in a great interplay of causes, and the remedy is a much ampler problem than any education act will cure. Take a typical young Englishman, for example, one who has recently emerged from one of our public schools, one of the sort of young Englishmen for whom all commissions in the army are practically reserved, who will own some great business, perhaps, or direct companies, and worm your way through the tough hide of style and restraint he has acquired, get him to talk about women, about his prospects, his intimate self, and see for yourself how much of him, and how little of him, his school has made. Test him on politics, on the national future, on social relationships, and lead him, if you can, to an utterance or so upon art and literature. You will be astonished how little you can either blame or praise the teaching of his school for him. He is ignorant, profoundly ignorant, and much of his style and reserve is draped over that. He does not clearly understand what he reads, and he can scarcely write a letter. He draws, calculates, and thinks no better than an errand boy, and he has no habit of work. For that much perhaps the school must answer. And the school too, must answer for the fact that although unless he is one of the small specialized set who what at games he plays cricket and football quite without distinction, he regards these games as much more important than military training and things of that sort, spends days watching his school matches, and thumbs and muddles over the records of county cricket to an amazing extent. But these things are indeed only symptoms, and not essential factors in general inefficiency. There are much wider things for which his school is only mediately, or not at all, to blame. For example, he is not only ignorant and inefficient and secretly aware of his ignorance and inefficiency, but, what is far more serious, he does not feel any strong desire to alter the fact. He is not only without the habit of regular work, but he does not feel the defect, because he has no desire whatever to do anything that requires work in the doing. And you will find that this is so because there is woven into the tissue of his being a profound belief that work and knowledge owe not pay, that they are rather ugly and vulgar characteristics, and that they make neither for happiness nor success. He did not learn that at school, nor at school was it possible he should unlearn it. He acquired that belief from his home, from the conversation of his equals, from the behavior of his inferiors. He found it in the books and newspapers he has read, he breathed it in with his native air. He regards it as manifest fact in the life about him. And he is perfectly right. He lives in a country where stupidity is, so to speak, crowned and throned, and where honor is a means of exchange. And he draws his simple straight conclusions. The much castigated gentleman with the ferule is largely innocent in this account. If, too, you ransack your young Englishman for religion, you will be amazed to find scarcely a trace of school. In spite of a ceremonial adhesion to the religion of his fathers, you will find nothing but a profound agnosticism. He has not even the faith to disbelieve. It is not so much that he has not developed religion as that the place has been seared. In his time, his boyish heart has had its stirrings. He has responded with the others to Ward, Christian soldiers, the earnest moments of the school pulpit, and all those first vague things. But limited as his reading is, it has not been so limited that he does not know that very grave things have happened in matters of faith, that the doctrinal schemes of the conventional faith are riddled targets, that creed and Bible do not mean what they appear to mean, but something quite different and indefinable, that the bishops, socially so much in evidence, are intellectually in hiding. Here again is something the school did not cause, the school cannot cure. And in matters sexual, in matters political, in matters social, and matters financial, you will find that the flabby, narrow-chested, undertrained mind that hides in the excellent-looking body of the typical young Englishman is encumbered with an elaborate duplicity. Under the cloak of a fine tradition of good form and fair appearances, you will find some intricate disbeliefs, some odd practices. He will trace his moral code chiefly to his schoolfellows and the intimates of his early manhood, and could you trace it back, you would follow an unbroken tradition from the days of the Restoration. So soon as he pierces into the realities of the life about him, he finds enforcement, ample and complete, for the secret code. The schoolmaster has not touched it. The school pulpit has boomed over its development in vain. Nor has the schoolmaster done anything for or against the young man's political views, his ideas of social exclusiveness, the peculiar code of honor that makes it disgraceful to bilk a cabman and permissible to obtain goods on credit from a tradesman without the means to pay. All this much of the artificial element in our young English gentleman was made outside the school, and is to be remedied only by extra-scholastic forces. School is only one necessary strand in an enormous body of formative influence. At first, that mass of formative influence takes the outline of the home, but it broadens out as the citizen grows until it reaches the limits of his world. And his world, just like his home, resolves itself into three main elements. First, there is the traditional element, the creation of the past. Secondly, there is the contemporary interplay of economic and material forces. And thirdly, there is literature, using that word for the current thought about the world, which is perpetually tending on the one hand to realize itself, and to become in that manner a material force, and on the other to impose fresh interpretations upon things, and so become a factor in tradition. Now the first of these elements is a thing established. And it is the possibility of intervening through the remaining two that it is now our business to discuss. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.